It is with no false kind of humility that I say it is a privilege to speak in this chair, in this room. It also is a great privilege for me to talk about somebody like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a privilege that that is even difficult for me to verbalize as I sit in my chalet an hour before this is supposed to begin and can barely imagine that it is happening to me. But I am privileged to do it, and I hope that you will find tonight, if you have not found before, a friend, an ally, and a spiritual leader in Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I want you to know that what I am doing tonight is no easy task for a number of reasons. Bonhoeffer lived few years. He did not write many books, but yet the impact on his life has really been staggering. And it can be said with little exaggeration that he is clearly one of the most influential theologians of the 20th century. Perhaps Karl Barth is the most influential theologian of the 20th century, but Bonhoeffer is close behind. The books that he wrote were few. The books about him are many. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. I will tonight introduce to you, if you have not been introduced before, the few books that he did write, and to do that we will have to travel briefly through his life. My hope really is that you will be struck with the power and the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and that you will be captured by the Lord of the Church, as was he, and that you will find some ways in which you can direct your own life based on the discoveries and the sacrifice that he made within his own. Somebody said of Bonhoeffer that he was the least schizophrenic person that they'd ever met. Now, what's a schizophrenic? It's a person with two personalities. Okay. Somebody said that Bonhoeffer was the least schizophrenic. That means that he did what he said. If he said he was going to do something, he did it. And if he preached it, he lived it. Something that few of us, especially us pastors, can ever say. So, in order to understand the books that he wrote, and the articles, and the comments that he made while he was in prison and elsewhere, it is crucial that we understand his life, where he was living, what he was doing, who he was seeing, where he was traveling. To understand his life is, in a way, to understand the books. Some people, you can just read the books and you'll understand. But with Bonhoeffer, it's very important to understand the life, and the life lends a lot of light to the literature. We begin with the end of the story. 1945, April 9th, and a man named Payne Best, a British officer, also a prisoner in a small camp called Flossenbürg, and it's the 9th of April, and Bonhoeffer will be hung this day. And this is the account of that from Payne Best. Bonhoeffer always seemed to me to diffuse an atmosphere of happiness, of joy in every smallest event of life, and of deep gratitude for the mere fact that he was alive. He was one of the few men that I've ever met to whom God was real and close. The following Sunday, April 8th, 1945, Pastor Bonhoeffer held a little service in the prison and spoke to us, that is the rest of the prisoners, in a manner which reached the hearts of us all, finding just the right words to express the spirit of our imprisonment and the thoughts and the resolutions which it brought. He had hardly finished his last prayer when the door opened and two men in civilian clothing came in and said, "Prisoner Bonhoeffer, get ready and come with us." Those words, "come with us," for all prisoners, they had come to mean only one thing, the scaffold. We bade him goodbye. He drew me aside. "This is the end," he said, "for me, the beginning of life." The next day, he was hung. Now, 3 years before this episode, from a prison cell, Bonhoeffer writes these words: "When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die." This is the story of a man who is, at 21, a professor of theology, a man who preached at the Olympics, a counter-espionage agent, a confirmation teacher in a Berlin ghetto, a musician, an athlete, a conspirator in the attempt to assassinate Adolf Hitler, and at age 29, the founder of an illegal seminary. An interesting and powerful person. Holden has been graced by the presence of many distinguished scholars through the years. One of them is James Burtness. Do you know the name? Okay. You know Jim Burtness. Luther Theological Seminary, St. Paul, Minnesota. Jim Burtness knows as much about Dietrich Bonhoeffer as anyone in the world, I expect. He spent a year in Germany going to all the places that that Bonhoeffer lived and where he taught. He met the relatives. He's read all of his books inside and out. He translated one of them here. Jim Burtness has been in this chair talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I am a first-week freshman compared to James Burtness and his understanding of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. In our library, there are some tapes. If you'd like to know more than what we can cover in a very brief time tonight, I certainly do invite you to listen to the tapes of Jim Burtness. Look under B for Bonhoeffer, please. Okay. What I'm going to do is go through his life quickly and year by year, and then we're going to look at life together. If it gets too long, just somebody say, cannot take this anymore, okay? And we'll just all go home or go to the sauna or whatever has to happen next. But if it gets too long, let me know, okay? And I'll move as quickly as I can. He was born on the 4th of February, 1906, to Dr. and Mrs. Karl Bonhoeffer. His dad was a physician, a psychiatrist, the first psychiatrist in Berlin. His mother was a musician and came from a distinguished family. His dad's relatives were all mayors and doctors and lawyers, and his mom's relatives were all doctors and mayors and lawyers with an occasional pastor scattered in between. He was a twin. His twin sister's name was Sabina. In addition to Dietrich and Sabina, there were four other children. I think this morning I said there were five. That was incorrect. There were six children altogether. They were born within a time span of 10 years. Those six children were... And the family was a very aristocratic family. Not very, just aristocratic. Upper middle class, to be sure. At age six, they moved to Berlin. They lived in a beautiful section of town in a very large home. They also had a home out in the country, up in the mountains, to the south. Their family life was very structured, but it was very warm. The children had the best education possible. They had music lessons and all sorts of lessons in athletic abilities and in all kinds of things. On Sunday afternoons, they had piano recitals in the living room. The Bonhoeffer family expected the best. They had always had the best from the 16th century and on. The graveyards were filled with Bonhoeffers, and all of them were somebody. So this family came to understand that they were somebody. And there was a high degree of expectation within the family. One of the neighbors who lived right down the street was Adolf von Harnack. Know that name? You don't know the name? Okay. Well, forget that then. You know the name,
yeah,
Adolf.
I'm impressed.
You better be. That's right. That's a heavy-duty neighborhood when Adolf von Harnack lives right down the street. Okay, the world's foremost historian. You got Adolf back
there.
He's
also a heavy-duty physicist. All right.
Is that right?
Yeah. Good friends of the family.
Max Planck, or who was that?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'll take it.
Okay. Good. The children are musicians, they are athletes.
In fact, his sister married the son of that physicist. I can't think of the name. They're his friends.
All right.
How do you get physics
name? Dietrich's oldest brother, Klaus, becomes a physicist and works with... Klaus wasn't the oldest brother. The oldest brother, anyway, becomes a physicist and eventually ends up working with Albert Einstein. By the time his older brother is 30 years of age, he is traveling to the USSR and to the United States to give lectures. The family is an accomplished group of people. Another brother, Klaus, was killed in the resistance movement, much like Dietrich was. In addition, two brother-in-laws were executed by the Nazis as well. The Bonhoeffer family always did the best, but they were never allowed to brag about it. There's one incident told where Dietrich came home from some sort of track and field event, and he had been given an award. It wasn't a blue ribbon, it was a wreath, and he wore it around his neck, and he came through the door, and all of his older brothers laughed at him. They said, of course you should win, but you should never brag about it. It simply wasn't tolerable. You do your best, you shut up, and you do best again the next day. And that was the way the family lived. They had a large summer home in the mountains. The children went there with their governesses and the cooks and the caretakers in the summertime, and Mom and Dad stayed in Berlin, and then they came out on the train and they visited. So that was the kind of family that it was. The church was of no particular importance to the Bonhoeffer family. They went to church at Christmas. When the children were baptized, they were baptized in the living room. The only members of the family who were pastors were on his mom's side, Mrs. Bonhoeffer's side. But at age 15, Dietrich decides to study theology, and so he enrolls in Tübingen University. All through his life, his relationships with his family remain very, very close. At 38 years of age, he's in Tegel prison, and he still writes to his parents. And he writes very affectionate and very deeply moving letters to his mom and to his dad. The affection and the loyalty of the family is something that keeps him and the rest of the family together through some very difficult times. It can be conjectured from his father and from his mother and from his family, he learned the value of the real as opposed to the imaginary. Overly emotional, overly imaginary conversations were not welcome in the Bonhoeffer home. Later in his life, he wrote that his father had a great dislike for phraseology, for the trite. You know, if that kind of conversation happened, his dad would just stop it right now and say, "Now, what's the real story?" You know, no exaggeration, no phraseology, no triteness, no fantasy. Tell the real story. That reality theme becomes a theme in all of Bonhoeffer's writings. There is within Bonhoeffer's writings a note of real religion, real danger, real faith, and real sacrifice. He is 21 years of age. He receives a doctorate after writing a dissertation called The Communion of Saints, Communio Sanctorum. It's now time for some parish experience, so in February of 1928, at age 22, he packs his bags, leaves home, and he leaves Tübingen University and Germany, and he goes to Barcelona, Spain, where he becomes kind of an intern or vicar in a German-speaking congregation in Barcelona. During that time, he visits Rome, and he is overwhelmed at St. Peter's Cathedral, where he comes to say the church is universal, a theme that he'll pick up later in his life. Now he's 24 years of age. He presents a paper by which he seeks to be admitted to the theological faculty at the University of Berlin. In order to get in, you present a paper, and all the rest of the professors, the distinguished professors, hear the paper. Dietrich's 24 years of age, he already has a doctorate, he writes a paper, and he presents it. It's called Act and Being. Don't read that first, whatever you do. That's heavy-duty stuff. Don't read Act and Being for a year or so. You can buy it now, but don't read it, okay, because it's a little tough. Read this other stuff first. Act and Being, and he gets in. Now, 1 month after being accepted as a professor at the University of Berlin, at age 24, mind you, he is sent to the United States, or is given the opportunity to go to the United States, to study at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. There he comes to know Reinhold Niebuhr. The name Niebuhr familiar at all? Yeah. Okay, Reinhold Niebuhr. And he meets on the ship going over to New York City at this time, he meets a man from India, his roommate. Actually, he doesn't meet him for the first 3 days. He just sees the cane and spectacles and luggage, but he can't find this guy in a great big ship. But after 3 days, finally, they meet, and he's a physician from India. They talk about pacifism and nonviolence. He knew about it before, but he became fascinated with it, and from that time on, he always planned to go to India. Later in his life, when he's in England, he'll make specific plans to go visit Gandhi to learn more about nonviolence, but that never does materialize. But that's the first time that he makes any clear record of being definitely interested in that. And then he goes to New York City. He's in Union Theological Seminary. There he is studying, and he meets a man named Frank Fisher, who is also a student at Union Seminary, and Frank Fisher is black. On Sundays, Frank Fisher goes to the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. And so Dietrich, not being able to tolerate American churches generally, he thought they were just awful. He thought the preaching was so horrendous. He's got some funny phrases about it, but it was bad. He didn't like it. But he loved the black church, and he loved Frank Fisher, his friend at the seminary, and so they go to the black Baptist church on Sundays, and Dietrich teaches Sunday school in the black Baptist church in Harlem. In addition to that, he's fascinated by music. Music's always been a big part of his life. He's a pianist, and so he learns some of the music. Later on, at the illegal seminary he establishes when he's 29 years of age, a part of the songbooks that they have on their table includes Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. Okay? So he brings that back. And then he writes, this is 1932, the young man, 24 years of age, the foresight was incredible. He writes, in 1932, the black people of the United States, the Negro people of the United States, are going to explode. This is an intolerable situation. Okay? Pretty perceptive, huh? For 24? Okay. Now, he's in New York, and he keeps a diary, and a part of it says, I hope to, on Sunday, he always started the diary by saying, I hope to hear a sermon today. And then he makes a note of where he went, like to hear Harry Emerson Fosdick or somebody like that. This was a time of great liberalism in the church, where you talked about self-improvement or about world visions or about roses and lilies or anything, but you didn't talk about Jesus a whole lot. So he always wrote on Sunday morning, I hope to hear a sermon today. And then in the diary, in the end of the day, he says, I did not hear a sermon today. It's a ding, ding, every Sunday, same thing. He always hopes, but it never happens. Now, after 1 year in the United States, which incidentally included an automobile trip with a friend, a Frenchman, who was a pacifist, an active, long-term pacifist, that he met a man on the boat who was, and then he met another man at Union Seminary who was, and he takes an automobile trip from New York City to Chicago, and he comes to the West Coast, and he goes down Highway 101, the car breaks down somewhere around Los Angeles, and they go on to Mexico City, and then back on a train to New York City. He has, somehow, the ability not only to perceive things far in advance, but he also just enjoys everyone. Everybody is fascinating to him. One of the things he does during his year at Union Seminary is to go to Cuba, to preach at a German church in Cuba. And he makes all sorts of observations about the Cuban people. He's just an incredibly perceptive person. So this trip was a part of his time. Now, after 1 year here, he goes back to Berlin. He's 25 years of age, and now he starts to lecture at the University of Berlin in theology. He's a popular professor. The classes fill up. And in addition to teaching at the university, he's also a pastor at a technical college in the city there, kind of a vocational school. During this time, he's writing lecture notes, and those lecture notes are contained in Creation and Fall. Okay, and Temptation, this is on the first three chapters of Genesis. So this is when he is about 25 years of age now, and he writes this first. I didn't show you this, and I wanted to. That's who we're talking about. Prison at Tegel. He was a year and a half in Tegel, then to Buchenwald, and another stop, and then finally to Flossenbürg, Maria. He was engaged to Maria just 4 months before he was sent to Tegel, and he said he carried her picture in his pocket all the time. And Maria now lives in Boston, or near Boston. Okay, let me show you those pictures. Writes Creation and Fall. That's the first book. From his father he learned, and from the whole family, that we will in the Bonhoeffer family talk about the real things, okay? No pretend stuff, the real stuff. So, while he is a professor, in addition to that, he becomes a confirmation teacher in a section of Berlin called W-E-D-D-I-N-G. Wedding? Is that familiar to you? Wedding? Okay, at the time, I don't know what it is now, but Wedding at the time was a slum. There's a pastor that's teaching a confirmation class, all boys, 50 kids. He gets sick, he can't handle it, the kids are driving him crazy. He resigns the job of teaching the confirmation class. 2 weeks later, he dies. Bonhoeffer says the kids must have killed him in some way or another. So he gets asked to teach this confirmation class. Now, he is a professor at the University of Berlin, but he goes to Wedding, which is the most, kind of the South Bronx of Berlin, and he teaches a class there. And his story is told the first day he got there. He was to be introduced by somebody, and they walked in the door, and the classroom was on the third level, so they had to walk up the stairwell, and all the kids were standing in the stairwell, throwing stuff down at Professor Bonhoeffer and this other guy as they were walking up the stairs. So they get to the third floor, and this other guy tries to keep all the 50 kids quiet, and he tries to shove them into the classroom, and he yells at them, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet. Finally, he gives up in desperation, and he walks out, and Bonhoeffer stands there all by himself, and he doesn't say a word. He just leans up against the wall, and he waits. And finally, all the kids are quiet after a while, because he won't say anything. And then in a very soft voice and very quietly, he said, could I tell you stories about Negroes in Harlem? And he starts to tell stories. They walk in the classroom, and he teaches them. This goes on for a long time. The relationship that he had with his confirmation class was a very, very close one. He used this very nice country home that his father had for a retreat for these kids. And he wrote a note to his parents saying, I hope too many windows were broken when the kids were up here from the city. And this was not done at the time, this idea of becoming a friend of the student and living in a community like they did. In addition to that, he could have lived at the University of Berlin. He could have had an apartment there, but he chose not to do that. He lived instead in the neighborhood. And he gave a key to his apartment to the lady that ran the apartment house on the first floor. And anytime the kids wanted to stop at his apartment after school, they could do that. Okay. So real. To teach is real, but also to live in Wedding and to teach a 50 boys' confirmation was real. When it came time for their confirmation exercises, they were also poor. They didn't have any nice clothes. So he got some money from his dad, and he bought a great big bolt of cloth, and he got somebody to make suits, made 50 suits for the boys. So they all got dressed up, and he went to church, and they were confirmed. Okay. So that's a part of the real Bonhoeffer as well. Now he's 26. And again, he is seeing ahead. Like in 32, he said the black situation in the United States is going to explode. One of the things he does at age 26 is already to establish ecumenical contacts. He's not happy just to live with Lutherans. He wants to know Catholics, and he wants to know pacifists, and he wants to know people from India, and he wants to know everybody. He becomes an ecumenical person early in his life, and that later on in his life causes him a tremendous amount of difficulty, but that's too long a story to get into. Now it's 1933. In January of 1933, on the 30th of January, who is elected to power? Huh? Adolf Hitler. Okay. The next day, Bonhoeffer is scheduled for a radio address over a major radio station in the city of Berlin. The title of his talk, the day after Hitler is elected, is Changes in the Concept of the Leader Principle. Before he finishes the speech, he's cut off the air, and he's ushered out of the radio studio. In the address, he attacks the German public for lusting after a leader who he said would become a misleader unless he refused to become the idol of the people. Okay, that's the day after Election Day. Okay. A month later, Hitler begins the systematic attacks on German Jews, eliminating them from public life and from the professions. Now he is 27 years of age, and he writes and has published and writes and publishes an essay called The Church and the Jewish Problem. By the end of 1933, Bonhoeffer, along with a man named Martin Niemöller, established something called the Pastors' Emergency League in an attempt to prophetically speak out against the unethical union of the Christian faith and the German government that was then developing. You see, what was happening was that there was an attempt on the part of the Reich and some cooperation on the part of pastors to team up the Nazi religion and the Christian religion. And they did it in some places in Germany, especially in the city of Berlin. It was called the German Christian Church. So the swastikas flew in the churches, and they held rallies in the churches, and the faith kind of got melded together, at least in certain parts of the country. So Bonhoeffer was asked sometimes, well, isn't that so bad? And he said, the question isn't, you know, is it three-fourths Christian and one-fourth Nazi? Or is it one-half Nazi, one-half Christian? He said, the whole thing, it's just a stinking cauldron. The whole thing is heresy. It stinks. And he rejects it. That's in 1933. He's 27 years of age. In order to respond to this German Christian heresy that had developed, he forms the Pastors' Emergency League with Martin Niemöller in an attempt to speak to this German Christian thing. Bonhoeffer rejects the notion of a union between the two. He says it's really not possible. I should say that most of the comments from here on will be about the church in Germany and Bonhoeffer's relationship to that church, as he was severely distraught by the church in Germany, so too as he drove in his Oldsmobile across the United States, and as he listened to sermons in New York City, he was equally distressed with the church in America. He found it no less Christian than what he had at home, just so that we'll keep that straight in our own mind. 1 month after forming the Pastor's Emergency League, he receives a call from two churches in London, England, to be their pastor. German-speaking congregations in London, he accepts that. He goes there, he spends 2 years there, and during that time he begins to write The Cost of Discipleship. He doesn't finish it. Now, in addition to writing there and being a pastor, he forms a friendship with a man by the name of Bell. He's the Bishop of Chichester And later on, in the underground, he has contacts with Bell, and the last day, the day before he's killed, Bonhoeffer says, send a message to my friend Bishop Bell, the Bishop of Chichester. There is a deep and meaningful relationship that starts out. Shortly after he arrives, the German-speaking congregation in London breaks all ties with the German Christian church across the channel in the homeland. One of the things that he does while he is there in London is to speak to the Western world, to write to papers in the United States and to the Union Theological Seminary and to anybody over here to try to explain what was going on in Germany. Because at the time, much of the church in the United States thought this was really swell. You know, the idea that the church in the United States was in horror at what was going on with Adolf Hitler and the merger of Nazism and the church is simply not the case. Some parts of the church were here. But Bonhoeffer saw part of his responsibility to speak to the Western world saying, you've got to know what's going on there. And he did that while he was in Germany. He's in London 2 years. He arranges a trip to see Gandhi. He's got the ticket on the passage on the ship. The letters are all sent. He's all ready to go to India. The whole thing is ready to happen. But then he receives a call from Germany to come back. He's 29 years of age now, to come back and start an illegal seminary for the Confessing Church. The group that protested against the German Christian marriage was the Confessing Church. The name is very significant, but we won't talk about all that. The Confessing Church. So Bonhoeffer becomes a part of the Confessing Church, which is a branch, or as a small group within the regular Church of Germany at the time, also illegal. He's 29 years of age. He's called to come back and head an illegal preacher's seminary. It's now the summer of 1935. It's 2 years after his radio talk was cut off the air. And he goes back and he helps to establish in the little village of Finkenwalde a seminary, 25 students on the Baltic Sea. It's a farmhouse. It's a training school for pastors in the Confessing Church. Here in Finkenwalde, they built the Bruderhaus. It was a community. It was life together. It was shared meals, shared work, shared confession, shared preaching, shared study. The only library in the place was Dietrich's library. 25 students and an occasional other teacher that would come in. This was life together. It'll be 2 years after that experience in Finkenwalde that he will write Life Together to describe what went on there. Before he leaves England to go over to establish the illegal seminary, he visits two Benedictine monasteries in England to understand better what monastic life is all about, because he saw that the only way for preaching to survive in Germany at the time was to establish this underground Protestant gospel monastery. Okay? It's possible, you see, to see the birth and the life of Holden Village in part drawn from that experience. 12 years ago, when Kay and I came here to be on the staff, we were asked to read Life Together. You were asked to read it as well. Life Together has been a key document in the life of Holden Village. Bonhoeffer sees that community, that Protestant, gospel, monastic community, is a tool for the future church. Hence, maybe, Holden Village. I can see some clear traces back to that. I don't know if it's all that clear to you, but I see some of that. While he is now at Finkenwalde, he finishes writing The Cost of Discipleship. As you read this book, and maybe this is the first one you read, please read chapter 1 about 5 times, and then read the rest. It talks about cheap grace and costly grace. Many of you have read it. He says, what we're living now under now is cheap grace. Just go ahead and do what you want. God loves you. Golly, after all, we're all friends, you know. Gee whiz. Cheap grace. Costly grace is something else. When you're living in Finkenwalde, and it's illegal, and there's 25 of you, and you're eating turnips and potatoes, a potato day to be sure, and you know that your future is in question, there is a cost to discipleship. Okay? There is costly grace required in that situation. So, the first chapter is extremely important, and reread that as many times as you possibly can. And then he goes on to talk about the Sermon on the Mount after that. In addition, at the same time, he does the book that Kay referred to the other day, Psalms the prayer book of the Bible. This one was translated by Jim Burtness, who has lectured here many times. So that's just a little companion piece for the people who were at Finkenwalde. While the seminary is now established, and the year is 1935, 3 months after it's established, the Nuremberg Laws are passed. The Nuremberg Laws canceled all citizenship for Jews in Germany at the time. The world doesn't seem to notice much, at least America didn't seem to notice it a whole lot. 1936, the year later, remember, they are in life together at this little Finkenwalde Seminary in the Baltic Sea. A year later, 1936, what happens? What goes on in 1936 in Berlin? Garmisch-Partenkirchen was the West. Huh? What? The Olympics, right? Mm. Who won the gold medal?
Jesse
Owens, that's right. Who refused to stand? Right. Remember that? Jesse won the gold, huh? And the Reich couldn't stand. Well, he is invited to preach at the Olympic Village. There are signs all over town saying, "Do not patronize Jewish establishments." They're taken down for the Olympics. And as a part of kind of the appeasement for the Western world coming in for their vacations to look at how wonderful things were going at the time in Germany, a part of that appeasement was to bring in various nice preachers to give little talks. So on the 5th of October, Dietrich preaches in the Olympic Village. He wasn't allowed to preach. He was allowed to give a lecture. And that was a big, big difference for him. Anyway, he did that on the 5th of October. On the 6th of October, the next day, his license to be a professor at the university was withdrawn. Okay, but he does it anyway. The seminary keeps operating up in the north part of Finkenwalde. Now it's in Poland, I think, or something. Now, in November of 1937, 2 years after the school is opened, the school is closed. 1 month after the school is closed, the cost of discipleship gets printed, and it's the first thing that people read. During the time, Bonhoeffer reassessed his stand as a pacifist. He hears from his brother-in-law, Hans von Danje, about a plot led by General Beck and an admiral in the Navy, a plot to assassinate Hitler. Later on in his life, people asked him, How could it be that you, a German Lutheran pastor, having read the Book of Romans, how could you possibly participate in a plot to kill the leader of our land? And he said this, that it's one thing to form an ambulance troop and to go out onto the streets and pick up people hit by a wild driver. That's one thing. But it's something else when you have to stop the driver of the car. That's why, he said, I did it. The driver had to be stopped. Anyway. Now, in this action, Bonhoeffer is again living with one of his fundamental principles, and that is that the Christian must accept his responsibility as a citizen of this real world, in this real situation, and do that, and live in that and do what he must. So now he is 32 years of age. The year is 1938. It is the year of the Kristallnacht. What's that? Did you see? Kristallnacht, the night of the crystal.
It's where they came and really took all the Jews.
Yeah, right.
To the camps.
35,000 Jews arrested on that night. All the synagogues of Germany were burned and destroyed, and the shops were confiscated. The year is 1938, and he's 32 years of age at the time. And then the next year, 1939, Hermann Göring liquidates all Jewish businesses. Now, in the spring of 1939, Bonhoeffer is living in London. He's in London. He visits his friend Bishop Bell again and Reinhold Niebuhr again and some other people, and they invite him to come to New York City. He was there once a few years earlier. Now they invite him to come back. He's gotten a reputation as an ecumenical leader, as a good theologian, as an excellent preacher, and as quite a scholar. So they invite him to come back to New York City. He's 33 years of age. He does it. He goes back on the ship, absolutely miserable. Can't stand it. 1 month he's there. And he goes to see the people who have paid for his passage back, and he says, I gotta go home. I just can't stand this. How can I, he says, participate in the reconstruction of Germany if I am not there for its death? So he catches a ship and he goes home. One of the last ships actually to leave New York City. And soon after he arrives, Germany invades Poland. France and Great Britain declare war on Germany. Now, from this time, Dietrich lives his life on two fronts. He is working for the confessing church, and at the same time, he is working in the resistance movement. In his spare time, he begins to write Ethics. He was able to stay up like till 2 o'clock in the morning and get up at 6 and go back to work. He never got tired. It's crazy. And he knew music, and he knew all the good restaurants in New York City. He made a list of all the good restaurants. He just had an interest in everything, you know. And he could work till all hours of the night, get up and be fresh and keep on going the next day, reading, and working all the time. So now he was a double agent. He is an employee of the German government. He's got papers. He's got money. He's got permission to travel on the railroad. At the same time, he is working as a member of the confessing church.
How was he an employee of the German government?
Pardon me?
How was he an employee of the German government?
Through his brother-in-law, Hans von Danje, who had a friend in the right place, and they just arranged the papers. He was a member of the German CIA.
Oh, so he really was a real double agent.
Yeah, right. So he was supposedly collecting information for the German CIA. At the same time, he was traveling all over Norway and hither and thither and yon, working for the confessing church and the resistance movement. Okay, now he's 34 years of age. He's in Germany.
Jim?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that important. If after he preached at the village, Olympic Village,
yes,
and his right to speak was taken away,
yeah,
and after all the other things, was it just that they didn't catch that somebody in the right place could pull that off and nobody caught that he was working for the CIA and was suspect from day one?
His brother-in-law, Hans von Danje, was a high-ranking official.
I see.
So they...
Was he a double agent too?
He was executed, so he wasn't a friend.
Yeah.
Right. It was not like they were getting these favors from low-level people. It was just right at the top levels that they were doing this. Okay. Now, he's 34 years of age. Germany invades Holland, Belgium, and France. In 1941, they invade the Soviet Union. Now, in 1942, Hitler is committed to the final solution of the Jewish problem. Do you remember that? Now, through his arrangements with his brother-in-law, Hans von Danje, he becomes this double agent. Now, 4 months later, April 5th, 1943, he's arrested. He knew it was coming. Hans von Danje, his brother-in-law, was arrested just a few hours before. So, the book Ethics, if you try to read that, you'll find it very frustrating, because this thing was written in train stations and all over the place, from Norway to Italy and back and forth again. It's really not a book. It was assembled by his friend Eberhard Bethke. It's four attempts to start a book called Ethics. So read it more like an encyclopedia than a book. Okay, it's not beginning to end a finished thing. It was scraps. When he was arrested in 1943, April 5th, 43, he took the copies of this thing and he went up into the attic and he stuffed it under the rafters and left some note for his friend Eberhard Bethke that's where it was. And so they got the thing out, and Bethke was the person who owned all of the rights to all of his books and stuff, so Bethke put it together. But it's not a book. It's four attempts to write a book is what it amounts to. So read that like an encyclopedia, if you will, please. He's taken to Tegel prison that I showed you earlier, and he's there for a year and a half. Now he writes, while he's in Tegel, he writes Letters and Papers from Prison. The first half of Letters and Papers from Prison is kind of a trite, in a way, because it's censored stuff. It's saying, it's writing home to parents and to friends, how's the weather, do you remember that good concert we went to, and gee, I wish I had a book to read. Okay, because it's all censored. So don't get discouraged with the first half of Letters and Papers. But at the second half, he becomes the unofficial chaplain of the prison. The guards become his friend. So the second half of Letters and Papers in Prison contains stuff that was not censored. So you'll find that a completely different kind of reading. And so that stuff got filtered out, and it got to Eberhard Bethke, it got saved, and it got into the book, and we have it here today. Now, he's in Tegel prison. The 20th of July, the attempt to assassinate Hitler fails. Bonhoeffer and Hans von Danje and others in his family and other friends were responsible for that plot. Two attempts, one in an airplane, a bomb that didn't go off, another at a cocktail party where Hitler left the party too soon. A man was wired with plastic explosives. He was supposed to blow himself up and Hitler as well. It didn't work. He was in prison at the time, and he knew this thing was going to happen. He was waiting for it to happen. And the attempt occurred on the 20th of July, 1944. Bonhoeffer receives word in Tegel prison that the attempt fails. And so he writes in his diary for that day, "My only consolation are the scripture texts of this day." Soon thereafter, a diary and other papers are found listing the people who were a part of the plot. Listed in there was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So the rights and privileges at Tegel prison that permitted this kind of letter writing were eliminated. Instead, he was shipped off to three different camps, ending finally in the camp called Flossenbürg. Now he's 39 years of age. It's the spring of 1945, and Heinrich Himmler gives the order that Bonhoeffer and these other people are to be hung at Flossenbürg. Now it is April 9th, 1945. He is taken to a deserted schoolroom. It was a small little classroom like Narnia over here. And it's 6 o'clock in the morning, and through an open door on the other, at one end of the schoolhouse, the camp physician is allowed to watch. And a year later, the physician writes that prisoner Bonhoeffer went to one corner of the vacant room, and he knelt in prayer and prayed fervently for some time, whereupon he was ushered to the scaffold and there prayed again, and then was hung by the neck until he was dead. His body was burned along with the other prisoners at Flossenbürg. 2 weeks after Dietrich was hung, his brother Klaus is shot by the Gestapo in Berlin. The same day his brother Klaus is shot, his brother-in-law, Rudiger Schleicher, is also shot by the Gestapo. 3 weeks after Dietrich is hung, Adolf Hitler commits suicide. 7 days after that, or 1 month after Dietrich is hung, the Allies receive the letter of surrender. So basically it was a month before the end. From cost of discipleship, this word. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. And then this poem he wrote, short poem. "God, who dost punish sin and willingly forgive, I have loved this people, that I have borne its shame and burdens and seen its salvation, that is enough. Seize me and hold me, my staff is sinking. O faithful God, prepare my grave." And then finally this one line. "Death is the supreme festival on the road to freedom." That's a very brief and very sketchy story of the life of Bonhoeffer. I don't know if you've got the energy or the will, I see drooping eyes, to do anything in life together, and I promised Karin we would. And I want to. This little book that describes those 25 young men on the Baltic in that illegal seminary is a powerful book, and we need to read it. It talks about life together, and it speaks to Holden Village, it speaks to me, and it speaks to all of us, our congregations, and the whole thing. It talks about John Schramm right in the first page, and all the rest of us too. Now we are weary, I expect, huh? If I give you a chance to leave, you all will. But if I don't, it's unfair. So, would you like to give me a... John's the consensus master around here. Tell me what's next, okay?
Can I ask a question in
life? Yeah.
Is there any comment on the apparent paradox between his interest in nonviolent pacifism and his involvement in the plot to assassinate Hitler?
Right, he gave it up. He never... This man, Eberhard Bethge, was his closest friend, the man to whom he sent most of the letters from prison, and this is the most authoritative biography on Bonhoeffer. There are others, but this is really the best one. And this is in the bookstore. Eberhard Bethge says he never did become a confirmed, fully committed pacifist. He was ready to go to talk to Gandhi, but he never arrived fully at that position in his life.
Let me speak to that, Dave, a little bit. Larry Rasmussen, who was here this summer, has a very good book on Bonhoeffer. Did his PhD on Bonhoeffer. He and I talked about that. He was greatly influenced by Reinhold Niebuhr. Niebuhr wrote to him and told him not to go to see Gandhi. Niebuhr was a member of Fellowship of Reconciliation until Second World War, until the war with Nazi Germany. Then he wrote a paper on why a Christian cannot be a pacifist, and it had great effect on Bonhoeffer. His premise was Gandhi's nonviolence as a political tactic worked because he was dealing with the English. His premise was Gandhi's nonviolence as a political tactic worked because he was dealing with the English. It will not work if you're dealing with an Adolf Hitler. That was Niebuhr's premise. Niebuhr held a high regard for a pacifism of witness, meaning an individual person who stood for pacifism. He did not hold a high regard for pacifism as the foreign policy of a power dealing with a Nazi Germany. So that had some effect. My understanding was Bonhoeffer considered himself a pacifist to the end. That if you read John Howard Yoder's book, Nevertheless, over in the library, which is 24 different kinds of pacifism, it will kind of end the idea that you have a single Gandhian or you never engage in violence. I mean, pacifism is broader than that. I think Bonhoeffer's primary thrust would be that he was a selective, conscientious participant. In the Vietnam War, a young Lutheran had to come to the Lutheran Church and plead his case for why he was a selective, conscientious objector. Bonhoeffer would say the bulk of the evidence is we're all conscientious objectors. There are occasions when we are selective, conscientious participants, and he felt Adolf Hitler was the time when he went against his basic understanding of the Christian faith, confessed that he was going against it, but still involved in the plot. I mean, there's been a lot of kind of analysis of it, but it's, I don't know, does that...
I think so.
I would like to recount a little tale of that I learned about a year ago that changed my feeling about the history of that time quite a bit. When I learned that this attempt to assassinate Hitler was not just a one-shot thing, they were going to try to get rid of this super ogre and then everything would be okay. And it was a very, very complex resistance movement in Germany that involved a great deal of long-term planning as to what they would do after not only Hitler, but some of the major officers in the army were removed from power. Who would take power? How would the transfer of power be achieved? Would there be widespread support among the German people? And that's part of why it took a long time in the planning. Bonhoeffer at one time sent a letter via Bishop Bell in England to contact Anthony Eden in England and Roosevelt in the U.S. to have them make some kind of public statement saying that if the government of Germany were overthrown, that the U.S. and England would come to terms with a new government in Germany and not pursue the war further. The U.S. And England evidently weren't willing to do that because that statement was never made. The reason the Confessing Church and the resistance movement wanted that statement was to rally the faith, the confidence of the German people in the Allies, so that they would know that, if Hitler is assassinated and if the government does change, then we will be at peace. And they felt that if the German people could believe that, that there would be a massive rallying behind a new government. But the attitude in the U.S. and in England was so strong, anti-German, and so much for total victory, that they were not willing to make the statement to that effect. They were going to pursue the Germans and take total victory over the German people, no matter what government was in Germany.
Yeah.
And I find that just an extremely depressing tragedy of that era that I had never known until about a year ago.
In Life Together, there are gems. There are statements like, our being together physically, bodily, the bodily presence of other Christians is a source of great joy. It is a gift. There are statements like, we should never expect to live in a community. We should expect to live, rather, with our enemies. Jesus did not live with his friends. He lived with his enemies. And so too for us. So any community we have is a bonus. It's frosting on the cake. Shall we work on this, or what shall we do? Well, I suppose I should not have maybe spent so much time on the one, but.
No, it's good. So basically what we did this morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. It is grace that we have each other to live with. We are united. The beginning of community and the end of community is Jesus. It's not whether we like each other. It's not whether we have anything in common. It's not anything of the sort. The beginning and the end of all community is Jesus Christ. The real Jesus, not some imaginary Jesus, not some imaginary community. Real community is formed on Christ. That's a part of it. Christian community means community through and in Christ. On this presupposition rests everything the scriptures provide in way of directions and precepts for communal life of Christians. Bonhoeffer is a Christ-intoxicated person. Okay. Or this. The person who wants more than Christian fellowship kills the fellowship. That is to say, he was looking for some extraordinary social experience in Holden Village, which he has not found elsewhere. He is bringing muddled and impure desires into Christian brotherhood. It is at this point that brotherhood is threatened, most often at the very start, by the greatest danger of all, the danger of being poisoned at its root, the danger of confusing Christian brotherhood with some sort of wishful idea about brotherhood. Or, God is not the God of emotions, but the God of truth. Or, he who loves his dream of a community more than Christian community itself becomes a destroyer of the community, even though the personal intentions be ever so honest, earnest, and sacrificial. Or, pastors should never complain about their congregations, certainly never to the people, but also not to God. A congregation has not been entrusted to a pastor in order that the pastor should become its accuser before God and men. Insert Holden Village for congregation. Okay? We should not be accusers of the congregation. Christian brotherhood is not an ideal which we must realize, but rather it is a reality created by Christ in which we may participate. He's saying to those 25 guys at Finkenwalde, look, we're not going to build some sort of neat brotherhood here. There's nothing we're going to do in the kitchen or out in the fields or in the chapel or anyplace else. We're not going to build Christian brotherhood by anything we do. But there is a reality called Christian brotherhood in which we may participate if we want to. The beginning and the end of community is Jesus, not our emotions, not our feelings, not our dreams about it. Within the spiritual community, there is never any immediate relationship. That is, we're not automatically friends. Just because somebody drives up the hill, gets off the bus, doesn't make them our friend. Just because I climb off the bus doesn't make you my friend. There is no immediate friendship in Christian community. No wish that it was even there. No dreaming that it should be. Rather, we understand that we are brothers and sisters to each other because Jesus stands between us. Okay. There is such a thing as human absorption. Bonhoeffer cannot tolerate people who try to control others. He wants people to stand on their own two feet. And in Christian community, he says, if the leader is a Pied Piper, if the leader of the community is somebody that we all kind of follow after and idolize, the community will die. Jesus is the head of the community, not the leader. There was a student who wanted to borrow some of Dietrich's books, and he said, oh, it was the only library they had. He said, oh, thank you so very much for letting me use your books. And Dietrich said, don't you ever talk to me that way. Grow up. He said, look, those are our books, so stop this nonsense. No kind of big Pied Piper in the village. If there is, we're in trouble. What else does he say? The existence at the right time in bringing out the ability to distinguish between the human ideal and God's reality, between spiritual community and human community. And he says about Luther League retreats and stuff like that. I mentioned this morning about going on Luther League retreats. Always took the kids on, remember, 3-day Luther League retreats, and you'd go, right? Some of you, or else you've taken kids on them. I told it today about Karen String's great uncle, William String, professor at Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa. He used to tell us, give me a few kids, give me 10 boys, and 8th grade boys, thank you, and a weekend, and some canoes up in north of Ely, Minnesota, and after those few days, with those 10 8th grade boys, I will come back, and they will promise never to kiss a girl. You know, never ever to kiss a girl. Bonhoeffer says the easiest thing to do is in 3 days to create the glow of fellowship. But it is the most destructive thing to long-term fellowship. This quick goal, this quick glow, I mean. He says it this way. That is why, as experience has shown, it is precisely in retreats of short duration that the human element develops most easily. Nothing is easier than to stimulate the glow of fellowship in a few days of life together, but nothing is more fatal to the sound, sober, brotherly fellowship of everyday life. It is not the experience of brotherhood, but certain faith in brotherhood that keeps the community together. Okay. He likes real stuff, real gospel, real danger, real faith, and real action. Okay, no illusions. He also doesn't like religious people very much, but we can get into that another time. Oh, ever heard of the Oxford group movement?
Yeah.
Okay, the Oxford movement has had a tremendous effect on American religion. When in America people are talking about, I want to give my personal testimony about what Jesus has done in my life. Okay, the root of that talking about what Jesus has done to me, the root of that is in part the Oxford movement. Some people from the Oxford movement came to visit Dietrich and his friends at Finkenwalde. And they said, gee, Dietrich, you, it looks like you got a good thing going here. We have a lot in common. Dietrich says, we have nothing in common. We have nothing in common at all. You don't ever preach the gospel. You talk about how wonderful you are. He says, you've replaced the gospel with the story of your personal success. It's irrelevant. He says, I don't care about what you've done. I care about Jesus, the real Jesus. So this stuff is really contemporary, you know. I mean, it's not just far. It's really important for today. He didn't like the people from Oxford too much who talked about what Jesus had done to me. But yet he's a Christ-intoxicated person. Jesus is the beginning and end of everything. Bonhoeffer is not some wild, raving liberal. No. but at the same time, he cannot stand drippiness. He just can't tolerate it.
It's amazing how far people came from his idea of religionless Christianity.
Oh.
And misused that.
Terrible.
And said that what he meant was there was no theology, or he meant was there was none of this drippiness. It really was the essence of biblical faith when he said religionless Christianity. But it's one of the scraps in that book. So they took his scrap and built whatever they... who was accused of being in that death of God theology by the secular meaning of the gospel. And it's either the miss or the burden of freedom. I just started reading the library copy. It's good. It's really good.
And I guess what I can say in conclusion is that the really important ways of understanding Bonhoeffer, that is what he says about the church and about faith and about sacrifice and about reality, we haven't even talked about that stuff. This is nothing compared to the breadth of what he does, you know, and what he's concerned with. We haven't even touched it. You know. So go away saying, I know hardly anything about Bonhoeffer, but I sure do want to read more. Okay.
Are we going to continue these things, Jeff? I hope.
Karen has a sign-up list for Life Together, which will be the first. Now, if after that there wants to be more reading in the village,
who's going to lead that?
I'll be the convener of it, I expect, but we'll just read it together like that. I mean, we're not.
We're going to have a week, at least 1 week.
Well, obviously, a week is not enough. Year is enough.
Wow. This is a... If you finished eighth grade, you are able to read this book. It is simple and clean and easy. At the same time, it is so profound. You know? So don't look for the trickiness in it. Just read it simple. And then... keep in mind, 25 students on the Baltic Sea and the Gestapo around the corner. Read that. And Holden Village. And this being one of the cornerstones of this village. And see if you make some connections. He says, the sooner we get disappointed with John Schramm, the better off we are.
Amen.
That's what he says. Just right quick. Sooner we get sick of our pastor at home, the better off we are. Jesus is the beginning and the end of the church.